This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
$55,000 towards the social care costs. If an individual's care costs exceed this limit, they would be eligible for full support from the government. Age UK supports the proposal and is calling on the government to establish a sustainable system of social care funding. Gloria Khamkar, FSRN, Southampton, England.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Our Washington, D.C. intern is James Helmsworth. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is just after 6 o'clock. Up next, we have Labor Radio. Keep it tuned here to KBOO Portland for great news and public affairs shows.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.afscmelocal88.org.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members.
Your way home to you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union, till the day I die. There once was a Union maid, she never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the Union Hall, when a meeting it was called. When the Legion boys come around, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union till the day I die.
Now this Union maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She'd never be fooled by a company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way when she struck the better pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me.
scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
Today is Monday, January 14th, and this is Labor Radio with your hosts Megan Heiss and Meredith Reese. Tonight we'll be sharing an interview with teacher activist Brian Jones about the struggle for true education reform. He is the narrator of the 2011 documentary The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, as well as a contributor to the book Education and Capitalism. First, an update in the ongoing struggle by former General Motors workers in Colombia to win justice for their workplace injuries and subsequent unjust terminations. Jorge Parra, president of the Injured Worker Association, has been on hunger strike for 56 days in an attempt to bring GM executives back to the negotiating table. It is a pivotal moment in the campaign as the North American International Auto Show opens in Detroit. Yesterday and today, with the support of the Auto Workers Caravan and others, Jorge has been demonstrating outside Cobo Center, while activists around the country have been organizing delegations to local GM dealerships. To find out more about this story, you can check out asotrecol.com. That's asotrecol.com. Now our interview with teacher, union activist, father, and actor Brian Jones.
So, my name is Brian Jones. I am a teacher and an activist in New York City. I've taught in New York City's public schools for 9 years, 8 years in Harlem, and last year in Brooklyn. This year, I am on an unpaid leave to help look after my daughter, who's a toddler, and also to pursue a PhD in urban education. And I retain my union membership. I'm very active in the United Federation of Teachers, and I'm part of a new caucus in that union called the Movement of Rank and File Educators, which is the Social Justice Caucus of the UFT. And we are running for office this spring to replace the current leadership of the UFT on a social justice platform. I'm here at the invitation of organizers with Save Our Schools Oregon and Third Rail Theater Company, who have put on a play called A Noble Failure, which is a play about the first, to my knowledge, in the entire country, the first time that there's a play about what now we know of as education reform, this wave of attempting to reform education along the lines of what they call business model privatization, you know, results-driven education based on metrics and standardized testing, charter schools, and all of that. This is the first time to put all of that together, to my knowledge, in a play. And so they generously found a way to bring me here to see the play, and then to give me an opportunity to speak to parents, teachers, students here also about all of these same issues. I wrote a chapter in Education Capitalism on the history of the struggle for black education, primarily in response to the idea that has become so pervasive that African-American families, especially lower-income African-American families, constitute a kind of undeserving poor. It's like there's something wrong with these parents. They don't value education. They're not helping their kids to do their homework, and you know they don't care. They're not passing on the right values, or there's something wrong culturally or in terms of values or this sort of thing. And what I tried to do, in many ways inspired by Howard Zinn's approach to history, was to look back at the history of African Americans and the struggle for education and take a kind of people's history view, take a view of the grassroots, often unheard of struggles of African American parents, beginning all the way with the first Africans who were kidnapped and brought here as slaves and were denied the right to learn anything, any kind of literacy instruction on pain of death, and yet did in secret. And what I uncovered in my research, which was not original research by any means, I was reading what historians have written, but gathering it together to make an argument, And the argument I came upon that I think is inescapable if you look at the actual history of what has happened is that there is probably no group of parents in the country's history who have systematically fought for education as have African American parents, actually. So if you want to talk about values and who cares, well, there's pretty much a solid, uninterrupted 400-year history of African American parents fighting against all odds for precisely that. I think that the way I think about it is that it's important to recognize, first of all, that there is still a struggle that is going on. There is still tremendous inequality in education in terms of funding, in terms of curriculum, in terms of a lot of things you can look at, like class size, like teacher experience. So the students who are most likely to have an inexperienced teacher, the students who are most likely to have an underfunded school, the students who are most likely to have very large class sizes, the students who are least likely to have fine arts instruction and actually have science labs with working Bunsen burners and sinks and all of those kinds of essential things that you need for science instruction, the people who are the least likely to have those things or most likely to have all of the bad things in education are students of color and especially African American students. So that still exists. The problem we have is that the so-called education reformers, really the people who one way or another represent a financial elite who are attempting to remake education in their own image and with their own priorities, they have taken up the cudgels of racial justice and made it their battle cry. They've wrapped themselves in the robes of the historic civil rights movement and claim to be doing all of this privatization in the name of racial justice. And that, unfortunately, does not fall on deaf ears. There's an audience for that because of what I just said, because there is a condition in the schools where there are parents and students who find themselves in unequal circumstances. And part, an essential part of that privatization's effort has been also to direct people's anger at not only the public sector in general, but at public sector unions and at teacher unions in particular, and to whip up parents to call for the blood of the union. Where parents find that the union has been indifferent to their plight historically, which unfortunately we have to say, in some cases it has been indifferent to their plight at best. In those cases, they have open ears for that argument. And then we find ourselves in a circumstance where the question of we as trade unionists in a profession that unfortunately is not as diverse as the communities that we largely serve, especially in the urban centers. So where there's this racial and social gap between who are the teachers and who are the communities. In that circumstance, for us as unionists to be somehow ignorant of or blind to or unwilling to speak out or unwilling to lend our voice in support of that, the plight of those students and parents, then we are effectively shooting ourselves in the foot. And we've boxed ourselves into a corner and cannot adequately even defend ourselves. And so we find ourselves at a moment where not just out of a kind of moral sense of right and wrong, or even you could say, you know, an ideological, theoretical question of what we should or should not do, but as a matter of life and death and as a strategic imperative, teacher unionists and teachers of all stripes, I believe, have come to a moment, a kind of existential moment for public education, where our fight to preserve our unions, to defend and to improve public education, calls into question public education itself, so we have to have something to say about that. The whole enterprise. We cannot just defend it as it is. We have to have a vision of what it should be, or else we're not going to win anybody over to our side. And part of that has to include a way for us to speak frankly and honestly about racial injustice where it persists in the schools, and for us to take a strong stance against it. And that is, to me, a matter of survival at this point for teacher unions. They have to take on this kind of a social justice angle or die. And where we've seen a union that has taken a different attitude, that has dared to fight back and challenge education reform, and where they have done so and lived to talk about it, survived a direct confrontation with some of the wealthiest, most powerful people in our country, it's where they have done just that. And the place that stands out, obviously, is Chicago, where they labored since a new group of teachers took over the union, got elected, who had this kind of an orientation, and then went on a campaign to not only try to win over, quote-unquote, parents and community members, but actually listen to them. Actually listen to what they have to say and what are their concerns and their priorities, and shift a power dynamic wherein it's like the teachers are up here and the community is down here, and like, you listen to us, and to really change that dynamic so that we can speak to each other as equals. It seems to me, speaking to people in Chicago and everything that I read and observed, that was a central part of what they did. And we see that as the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, tried to isolate the teachers, tried to demonize them day after day in press conferences, it had the opposite effect. And the way that the Chicago Teachers Union plainly and frankly came out and called out things that were going on in the schools as apartheid, used that kind of strong language, really connected with people who experience it as apartheid, for whom that is an ordinary, everyday, sensible thing, sensible term to use to describe it. Might be shocking to others, but to people experiencing it, of course it is that.
You are listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Our guest tonight is Brian Jones, who gave a talk on Friday organized by Oregon Save Our Schools called Real versus Phony Education Reform, Still Separate, Still Unequal.
The people who are promising racial justice through privatization, through charter schools and competition and all of these kind of things have very little to show for it in the places where they've gotten their way the most, where they've gotten what they wanted, been able to destroy the public schools, rip them up, destroy the teachers' contracts, organize the whole thing on a competitive basis of competitive portfolios of schools. New Orleans. They have not created racial justice. And in fact, New Orleans is the most dramatic example because they've gotten what they wanted in the most extreme way because of the hurricane. And the results are the most atrocious when it comes to racial justice. And so we see that simply letting the market do its thing in the free market of schools does not create justice, equality. It's not about that. It's the opposite. What they have now in New Orleans is a very hierarchical structure of schools, going, you know, starting at the bottom with the recovery district schools, the public schools, the repository schools, the darkest students, the poorest students, the students with the most needs and the least resources and the least attention and the least experience. I mean, everything that we've described is like the dramatic racial problems going up. Series of charter schools and selective schools all the way up to the top, where you have the whitest, and getting whiter all the way up to the very top, the wealthiest students in the most selective schools, that kind of thing. So the most extreme stratification in a place that promised that if you let us do it this way, we will have the most equality.
I also, you said that you were a teacher in Harlem, and that's been one of the kind of focus. You know, the focus of the charterization program. I mean, do you have any, just living through that since No Child Left Behind, any anecdotes or any advice or things you want to share with us about what that's been like to actually live as a teacher?
Yes.
To live through that.
Okay. One dynamic we saw was that it's very important for us, those of us who have a stance against the charterization and the privatization, all of that, to still have this attitude like there's a reason that parents have an ear for the privatizers and the charter school people, and to understand that. And understand that there's a difference between a parent who's just trying to do the best for their kid and a CEO who's paying themselves $500,000 to oversee a chain of charter schools that, you know, serve a few hundred kids. So there's a big difference between those two people. And the one The former has the potential to be our ally and should be our ally. We have to always keep that possibility open. And the latter, probably not. So we found ourselves in situations where, yes, we were protesting a school would move into a public school building and just totally abuse the public school students and push them into boiler rooms and small spaces and all kinds of things that were horrible. And yes, we would protest at those charter schools and sometimes draw the ire of the charter school parents and get into arguments and disagreements at public forums, all kinds of ways that, yes, we clashed sometimes with charter school parents. But we also always kept open and always kept an attitude of, we understand that you are trying to do the best for your child. What we're saying is that these charter school operators have another agenda. It's different than your agenda, which is just trying to get the best thing for your kid. And here's why we think you should be concerned about what they're doing to these public school kids. And often as you peel away and start to, you know, if you have a deeper conversation and you're open to that, you know, you're able to actually make a common cause. And what we found was that as the process unfolded and as people had experience and time went on, they had experience in the way that the school was pushing out the hardest, the most difficult students, excuse me, the students that were the most expensive to serve with lots of special needs. The more they saw, it was a very rigid, you know, kind of no excuses model, very zero tolerance behavior policies. The more they saw extreme focus on testing, the more that these kinds of things played out, there's more and more layers of parents became disaffected and also became more savvy and aware of what this thing really was, despite its claims. And some of them came over to our side. People who had literally been yelling at us, we found were yelling with us. And so I think it's very important for everybody as we move forward to be aware that that is a potential dynamic out there. And then ask yourself, how are we setting ourselves up to reach out and just always keep open the possibility that these people, through their experience, will come over to our side of this? How are we listening to them? How are we having a genuine discussion between people who we agree are all trying to figure out the best thing for our kids? There's also just the horrible dynamics of competition, which to me raises big questions about the public sector, about, you know, we had this whole debate about healthcare, and it's like, should there be a public option? Should there be just this thing where you just get healthcare, you know, tax-supported healthcare and all this kind of thing? And what do you know? Most people were for a public option, something where you were going to take profit out of it, take all these administrative costs out of it, and just give people healthcare, tax-supported healthcare. And that didn't happen. But similarly, I think people need to think about the public schools in a similar light, because what we found was, for example, we found ourselves in competition with a particular chain that had retained the services of a Madison Avenue advertising agency. I'm not kidding. They had paid over $1 million to have advertising campaigns for a school. So my parents would come to me angry, like, how did these people get my address? And they would show me, hand me, a glossy, full-color, fold-out brochure. And then the next week, they'd have another one. And the next week, they'd have another one. Some got as many as 12. To thousands and thousands of parents. You know how expensive that would be? And then you're walking to school in the morning. You're walking through Harlem. And at the bus stop itself, you know, is covered with, it, not covered on the outside, it, on the inside, like somebody paid a tremendous amount of money to be, have an official, large advertisement for a school. And then you have on the buses, and then you have on TV. So then my principal came to me one day and was like, Brian, you have computer skill, can you produce a brochure for our school? And I'm like, okay, I can't produce that. So I was like, well, do you have a brochure? Like, do we have a brochure now? And she's like, oh, yeah, we have a brochure somewhere. So she's looking around for a brochure. She hands me this, like, grainy, photocopied, you know, it's like 18th generation photocopy. Who knows where the original is, you know? So it's like that faded, you can't see the people's faces kind of thing. So then I set about trying to make a brochure. But then I asked myself a question. Should I have to spend my time making a brochure? Should my school hire someone to make a brochure? Should we open an office in the school and use space in the building to oversee advertisement and that kind of thing. Should we retain the services of a Madison Avenue firm? Should we spend more and more of our public education dollars on the competition over students? Or should the growing portion of, like, what should the dynamic be? Should it be we're trying to figure out how to spend more and more of our school money on the classroom, or more of it on the field of competition between the schools? Because the dynamic of any competition is, like, you know, if you bring a dagger, I have to bring a dagger. If you bring a gun, I have to bring a gun. If you have an ad on the bus, I have to figure out how to do something equally and matching if I'm to stay alive in my competition with you. And so that dynamic is, I think, very unfortunate and raises really important questions about whether or not a competitive free market model makes sense for something like education.
And on that note, a lot of these events are happening in Portland around a number of Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. celebration events as well. And, you know, you've written quite a bit about Martin Luther King Jr. and kind of coming to some similar conclusions about the way in which the world works and how to get real justice.
Well, certainly you could say his last campaign to fight for public sector workers trying to organize a union in Memphis, the sanitation workers, would be a great example, because there he brought out to the public a kind of vision of, I mean, he was in those years really, and not just in that particular struggle, but in that whole period of time where he tried, especially after the March on Washington, where he tried more and more to bring out a more social democratic vision for the direction that the country as a whole needed to take. And the way that he, I don't think it's right to say that he moved on from the struggle for racial justice to a struggle of economic justice, but that he increasingly spoke about the way that those are intertwined. And the more I learn about King, the more I'm amazed at how he was onto that idea earlier and earlier in his life. So I've also become convinced that it's not exactly right to say that he completely changed from somebody who just wanted, you know, better seating arrangements on the bus to somebody who wanted broad economic changes. But it is true that he changed in terms of what he thought was possible and what he openly argued for, and the way that he approached fighting for those kinds of things. But it does seem clear that he was onto some of those more radical ideas earlier in his life than has previously been acknowledged. There's a fantastic quote where he says that the enemy of the Negro is the enemy of labor. They're one and the same. And I feel like that kind of a message is a little bit of a warning, or should be, to us, to people who come and tell us that the problem is the unions. You know, well, do those people really have our best interests at heart? Because aren't these little black children that the philanthropists are so concerned about, aren't they going to grow up at some point and not be children and be workers somewhere? And what rights are they going to have on their jobs when they grow up? You know, you see that many of the people who are so involved, so concerned, you know, and so magnanimous, and, you know, with their largesse and their philanthropic love for children, who seem to have a different attitude towards adults. Let's make so many examples. Walmart, the Walton family, the owners of Walmart, are heavily invested in charter schools, in everything that's happening in privatization. So they care so much about the children and their development. And yet we see that Walmart has so many adults working for them, nearly full-time hours, who fall below the poverty line and qualify for public assistance. So could it be that Walmart's strong anti-union bent is not in the best interest of children, or in the interest of adults? You know, King also said that justice is indivisible. Threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I think that we should look at this whole education struggle more like, animated more by the idea that the interests of children are tied up and bound up with the interests of adults. That if you beat up on adults, you can't be getting justice for children. You know, my partner's a nurse, and if her employer overworks her, Is that a way to get better health care for her patients? No, it's actually the opposite. The more they squeeze her, the worse it is for her patients. Actually, her interests and the interests of her patients are bound up together. And similarly, I think that we have to see the conditions of teachers and the conditions of students as intimately connected. The caucus that I'm a part of, the Movement of Rank and File Educators, has a slogan that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. To try to draw that connection in the public mind and to say that that's what guides us is that vision that we feel our fates are linked here. And their attempt to pit one group against the other is ultimately in neither of our interests.
That was New York elementary school teacher Brian Jones, who blogs at brianpjones.tumblr.com. And you can find out more about the play Brian mentioned, A Noble Failure, by going to thirdrailrep.org. And that's it for this edition of Labor Radio, radio of working people, by working people, for working people, on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is about 6:31. That was Labor Radio. Up next, we have Prison Pipeline. Keep it tuned here to KBOO Portland for your great news and public affairs shows.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
And Labor Radio was brought to you in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social conditions of its members. Information at ubc156.org. And keep it tuned here for Prison.